You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. For those of you who don't know me, I'm John Thornton, the chairman of the Brookings Institution. It's my great pleasure to introduce this, both the topic and this particular panel. This is one of the occasions in which Brookings has taken all of its capability across the institution and applied it to a particular problem. In this case, the problem being the fiscal situation in the United States and how to get the country's economy moving again towards a growth trajectory. The genesis of this goes back 2 years ago at a trustee meeting in which a number of trustees and scholars got together and started talking about the state of the U.S. economy and how to get it moving and what we could be doing to make a contribution to that. And since then, the scholars have been working very assiduously on this, and they're publishing the paper today, which you've all got copies of. So, speaking for myself, I would regard this as a particularly important meeting and a particularly important topic. Darrell West, Martin Bailey, Bruce Katz, you all know them very well, represent three different policy centers at Brookings. And they're going to go for the next half an hour or so. Then Glenn Hutchins is going to come up, another one of our trustees, very involved in this process, and speak for a few minutes, introduce Senator Warner. And then the meeting will convene. I want to also say that there are three or four trustees, Steve Denning, who's still here, Dominic Barton, who's not here, Klaus Kleinfeld, Ann Fudge, and Glenn, who have been very involved in giving some good impetus to this and bringing in sort of the real-world economy into the conversation to interact with the scholars. So Martin or Bruce?
I'm going to start off. And thank you, John, and Glenn, and Steve, and so many of the others who have been involved in this. I just want to set the context for the conversation, give you a quick overview, then Martin will proceed. So let's just talk about some of the facts. Great Recession was a wake-up call, 8.8 million jobs lost. We've only regained 20% of the jobs lost, and if we were on track to just repeat the April performance, about 244,000 jobs lost, it would take another 29 months to make up the jobs deficit. We seem to have a Brookings logo there, but maybe it'll go away. About 1 in 10 Americans are unemployed. It's about 15 million Americans. And 43% of the unemployed have been unemployed for more than 27 weeks. It's long-term unemployment. 14% poverty. A jump of about 4 million between 2008 and 2009. 43 million Americans live below the poverty line. And then this slide, 3 in 4 people either lost their job or knew someone who did. Okay, so this was a different kind of recession than the early 80s, early 90s, early part of the last decade. Really profound implications. There's no going back. The economy that preceded the recession, we had housing on steroids. We elevated consumption over production. We lost the fundamentals in so many ways. So our search with the trustees and many of these business leaders from the outside is to focus on a new growth model and focus on a new playbook. And what you're going to hear are really three things. Martin's going to describe the need to get our fiscal house back in order. I see Alice here. Absolutely critical to unlock capital to invest in the productive sectors. I'm going to focus again on a vision of the next economy and the need to prioritize investment in a certain segment of economic drivers. And then Darrell's going to walk through improving government performance, integrated more technologically savvy, to again undergird this recovery. Martin. There
you go. Thank you. Let me state the obvious. The U.S. economy is still recovering from this deep recession. I had expected, and many had expected, that we would be in full fledged recovery by now with growth in excess of 3, maybe even excess of 4%, but that does not appear to be the case. We are around 2% in the first quarter. It looks like we're going to be between 2 and 3 in the second quarter unless things look up. So this economy is still fragile. One implication of that is that I think a sharp fiscal consolidation immediately would be a mistake. I think the U.S. does have the capacity to continue to borrow at the rate that it's borrowing now for the rest of this year, maybe into next year. When we hit that cliff, I'm not sure, and we don't want to push the limit on that. But I do think we have the capacity to not do what Ireland and the UK and maybe some of the other European countries have been forced to do, which is to do a quick fiscal consolidation and pay the price in terms of slowing down or even reversing the recoveries that they were experiencing. Now, I do want to put a slightly different slant on the deficit than most people do. It's obviously true that we're worried about the debt limit, we're worried about our ability to borrow, and we're worried about handing on a lot of debt to our children. But the thing that I want to emphasize is that doing something about the deficit over the longer run is a crucial part of the U.S. becoming more competitive, expanding its manufacturing output, and reducing its trade deficit, which is dominated by manufacturing. We import a lot of oil also, but that's probably not going to change in the short run. Okay, so as it says here, we've experienced very weak employment in manufacturing. It's dropped from 17 million to 11.6 million. It's slowly recovering. What can we do to at least preserve jobs in manufacturing? We have to make room for that in our economy. And the key to that is to make sure we have enough national saving. There is a counterpart between the national saving and the trade deficit. So this chart, which is nicely animated, courtesy of Bruce's colleagues, is the rest going to come in, or do I have to press again? There it goes. It comes in. Okay. So if we just do business as usual, we get $8.45 trillion increase in the amount of debt that we have to carry. That's the CBO forecast through now to 2021. If we do things that a lot of people want us to do, which is extend the Bush tax cuts and do a fix for the AMT, we'd actually get to an additional $12 trillion of debt. So that's a pretty scary scenario. So I don't think we can actually borrow that much over the next 10 years. We sort of borrowed a heck of a lot, 85% of the world's available surplus capital we borrowed over the previous 10 years. I'm not sure we can do the same again to this degree. But even if we could, I'm going to argue that it's a mistake. We can't do that. We've got to put in place now something that will change this dynamic going forward. One way to illustrate this, and I've done a little simulation exercise, there are a number of moving pieces. Back in the 1990s, I mistakenly thought there was a very direct link between the budget deficit and the trade deficit, and that turned out to be wrong. In 2000, we had a budget surplus, but we still had a trade deficit. And the reason that prediction was wrong was because private saving went down even as the budget was balanced. So we ended up with no more national saving at the end of the 1990s, or very little more than we had before. Doesn't say it wasn't a good thing. I'm proud of the fact that I was in the administration when we balanced the budget. It was a good thing to do. But it didn't, in the end, solve the trade deficit problem. So what do we have to do then as a country to make enough room so that we can have roughly balanced trade? We do have to do something about the deficit. We've stepped backwards on that, gone back to huge deficits. So that's number one priority. We also have to be concerned that the private saving rate and the numbers that I give there, 4.9%, which was the level we had in 2007, and 7%, which is sort of where we've gotten to as a result of the recession, that includes both corporate saving and household saving. Household saving has traditionally been very low in the U.S. It's now come up a little bit. Corporate saving is still fairly high. So we don't have to necessarily go to 10%, although that would make our lives a little easier in the long run. But we have to have a decent rate of private saving if we're going to make room in our economy for that manufacturing sector to expand and for the trade deficit to go down. So it's quite a demanding scenario we have ahead. Now, there are other ways in which the pieces of the puzzle could fit together. We could stop investing, for example. That's obviously not such a great idea either. Going in the other direction, we could find that even though we balance the federal budget, states and localities start running huge deficits, which they're in danger of doing because of all the pension liabilities and all the stresses they're under right now. That wouldn't be such a great idea either. Mostly they are prevented from doing that by balanced budget amendments. But if that were to happen, that would to make the challenge of improving national saving to be even tougher. So these numbers that I put up here assume that the states do get back to balance. And as it says here, if the saving rate, the national savings rate, corporate and household, stays at around 7%, then we can get our trade deficit, our current account deficit, down and make room for manufacturing and tradable services within our economy. So how are we going to do that? At this point, all the ideas are sort of on the table. I would be very happy to take the Rivlin-Domenici program. I would even be happy to take the Bowles-Simpson program if somebody would support it. Either of those or some combination of those would certainly provide the answer. I think many of us that are part of that, those proposals, and many of us here at Brookings would like to see some of the tax expenditures capped. I don't think we should eliminate them tomorrow, but mortgage interest deduction, health insurance payments, state and local taxes. Now, all of those have got big constituencies behind them, so dealing with those is no easier than raising tax rates or imposing a value-added tax, which is in the Rivlin-Domenici plan. So all of the options are lousy, and obviously controlling expenditures, and that means in the end entitlement expenditures has to be part of this story as well. Let me stop there and hand off to Darrell.
Actually, it's Bruce.
Sorry, go back to you.
That's okay. So building from that, if we do get our fiscal house in order, how do we think about investment again, particularly on the public side? And that really requires us first to have a vision of the next economy. And as many of you have heard, the vision that we're focused on here is a vision of an economy that is driven by exports and powered by low carbon and fueled by innovation and rich with opportunity. So obviously, why exports? Because demand is coming from abroad. Brazil, India, China, these countries are urbanizing and they're industrializing and they're creating markets for American goods and services. Here's part of the challenge. Only 13% of our GDP comes from the export sector compared, obviously, to much higher levels in China, Canada, India, Japan, and the European Union. And obviously, the European Union hides the export powerhouse of Germany. Why low carbon? Because our view is everything is about to change at varying degrees of speed. The energy we use, the infrastructure we build, the products we buy, and essentially the built environment to a lower carbon regime. The challenge is our competitors, Germany, China, Brazil, are setting the platform for clean energy growth. And in China's case, they're frankly subsidizing their way to clean energy growth. They want us to purchase the clean energy products from them. And they're about 65%, I think, of the solar panel market right now. With regard to innovation, now innovation is obviously always the fuel for economic growth and productivity. But going forward, it's not just about the United States being a generator of the next ideas or the inventions. As really Martin has said, we need to make things again in the United States. We will innovate less if we do not produce more. And the economy we inherit, with regard, for example, to advanced technology products, is an economy where production has shifted abroad. Design and idea generation may still be onshore. Going forward again, we will innovate less in this and other sectors unless we produce more at home. And finally, opportunity. If you actually built an economy like that, it would yield many more jobs with better wages and higher benefits. Here's the challenge. We're going through a major demographic shift in our workforce from about 25% African American and Hispanic to 40% African American and Hispanic, and there are huge disparities on post-secondary education, high school education, across racial and ethnic groups. It's not just an issue of equity or fairness anymore. It's a competitive proposition for the country. Last piece about the next economy. It will be determined, it will be delivered, it will be shaped by metropolitan America, the same way the Chinese economy is being determined, delivered, and shaped by their metro areas, or Europe. 100 metropolitan areas, after decades of growth, are now two-thirds of our population, three-quarters of our GDP, are on every asset that matters, innovation, infrastructure, human capital, 75, 80, 85. 95% of the national share. We are still a country that thinks we're a network of small towns. Wake up, We're a metropolitan nation. We need to act like one. So what do we do? We have short and long term. Set the rules of the road. We need to get back in the trade game again. We've got three FTAs before the Congress. We need to move these. On long-term strategy, we've got to streamline the process for approving patents. We have about 700,000 patents stuck at the patent office. There is legislation moving right now, so short and long-term. But then there's investments. We have to cut to invest. If we actually cap the mortgage interest deduction at this fiscal year's level, we would generate $166 billion over the next five fiscal years for deficit reduction and investments. What do we invest in the short term? On innovation, extend the R&D credit, create a network that's just begun of energy innovation hubs or energy discovery innovation institutes based on the German model, applied research, research moving quickly to market. On long term, we need a better system in a unified way for commercializing idea generation, and Martin's idea of establishing a manufacturing innovation fund at the national scale with resources allocated by evidence as opposed to political log rolling is a great idea. On infrastructure, hopefully Senator Warner will talk about the National Infrastructure Bank. It's been an idea around how do we leverage public resources with private sector investment in transformative infrastructure. So much of the Recovery Act was used to fill potholes, right? We did not modernize our ports. We did not invest in the next generation of freight rail or transit or EV infrastructure at the scale we need. So how do we set that public platform for private sector investment? On the national greenback this Monday, Cameron's government in the UK announced their green investment, $3 billion to leverage up about $15 billion. Every country has a play in the low-carbon economy, but it's this special mix of public-private investment which is necessary. And on human capital, Daryl has talked and written about this so much, we have got to facilitate skilled immigration. We've got to double H-1B visas. We've got to stamp a green card on anyone who is educated in the United States from abroad. We are educating the best talent in the world here, and then we're sending them home. We've got to change that, and we have to change that quickly. But over time, we've got to build this incredible infrastructure we have of high schools, skilled providers, and community colleges, a feeder network for the next economy, mostly at the metropolitan scale, as I've described. And now, Daryl West.
Thank you. The part of growth through innovation that I've been working on is the topic of improving government performance. Now, some people view that as a contradiction in terms, improving government performance. You know, what's wrong with that idea? They think government can never perform any better. It can never be efficient. It can't do many of the things that we see in the private sector. But in our paper, we argue that government can and should do better. It has to do better. It really doesn't matter what issue you care about, whether it's the deficit issue, improving exports, improving manufacturing, healthcare, infrastructure, you name the issue. We have to have a functioning political system to address any one of those issues. It's clear from a governance standpoint that the United States is at a crisis point. Our political institutions are performing poorly. There was a CNN opinion research survey last year that came out that found 86% of Americans said they believe the federal government is broken. And, of course, that makes you wonder about the other 14% that thought it was smoothly functioning, like what government are they actually looking at? Citizens are cynical about American politics. They're disengaged. They don't participate in large numbers. They think Wall Street and special interest groups get all the benefits. They feel that their privacy is under assault by some of the very new digital technologies that are popping up on the scene. I actually have a new book that was just published by Brookings Institution Press, hot off the press this morning. Phil got a copy, so he got the copy number one. It looks at the next wave of digital technology and how it can further social and political innovation. So I present a number of different ideas in there about what we can do differently to make a difference in the public sector. In our governance studies program and in our Center for Technology Innovation, we're working on various aspects of public sector innovation. I argue that governments must learn to innovate. They must learn to integrate. They have to focus on outcomes. We need reforms that make the government perform faster, smarter, and in a more efficient manner. New technology is going to be part of that. Although technology is not the only solution to this. I'm not a technology determinist, even though I study technology. When you look at the technologies that actually are transformative, typically we combine new technology with new organizational structures. And I think when we're thinking about government, both of those things are key. The new technology, but new agencies, new organizations, new ways of thinking about how the public sector operates. I want to give a couple of examples from the area of information technology, because in the private sector, we have seen companies show tremendous improvements in productivity and innovation. There are many companies, some of which are represented here in this room, that have become much more efficient and productive in how they operate. Very little of that sense of innovation has crossed into the public sector. We have a government system that was designed for an agrarian era in which the United States was not a dominant world power. And so we need to think differently about our political institutions. We need systems that function, that make decisions. We need more pragmatism. We need less polarization, and we need more civility. When you think about the IT component in the public sector, the federal government spends nearly $80 billion a year on technology. $20 billion of that goes for hardware, software, and file servers. But yet, we have information systems that cannot talk to one another, and policymakers have been slow to innovate in education, in healthcare, and in the economy. The federal government devotes less than 1% of its IT budget to cloud computing. In our research, we have found that governments can save 25 to 50% just by moving applications to the cloud. So that's something that has been found to be true in the private sector and some of the local government agencies that are starting to embrace technology. We can use technology to improve communications and deliver more reliable services to citizens and businesses. Social media offer potential for better performance. It's a way to improve two-way communications in the public sector. It's easier for policymakers to get information out to constituents, but then it's easier for them to get feedback on what's going well and what's not going so well. We need improvements in data transparency. One of the things the Obama administration has done has been to put a lot of effort into boosting transparency, putting more information online. Congress just cut the budget, and so many of these websites that promote transparency are now being scaled back. Privacy is a definite problem in this new digital world. Citizens are very worried about what both governments and businesses will do with online information. The problem in the consumer area, we see it every day in the newspaper. People worry about Apple, Google, Facebook, Sony, and other companies. As we put more information online, people are worrying more about confidentiality in terms of healthcare. There's going to be more information that is available in people's electronic medical records. In the national security area, people worry about legal rights and unwarranted government access to personal information. So this is an area where Congress has been slow to legislate, even though there are real concerns there. Congress needs to address these privacy issues, the legal issues, and some of the cybersecurity concerns that are out there in order to balance the various goals that we have. So we need a government that is as nimble as are the individual citizens and the businesses that are out there. We need to unleash the entrepreneurial energy in our economy. All of the objectives that we outline in our paper, rebalancing the budget, facilitating exports, reforming education, making energy more efficient and more innovative, requires leaders at all levels of government to pursue integrated strategies and coordinated action plans. In the conclusion of our paper, we suggest governments at all levels need to develop business plans for economic growth. We need leaders who wake up every day thinking about how to create jobs and rebuild our international competitiveness. There are lots of dimensions on which the United States is now starting to fall behind. not just in terms of technology innovation, but the manner in which our system operates. So we need business plans that provide a framework for engaging both business and civic leaders in targeting resources in areas that are going to be most productive. Governments need to leverage private resources to pursue some of the broader public objectives that many of us feel are important. We think this would help rebuild a stronger economy, that it's possible through a pragmatic caucus, both of citizens and leaders, that we can do a better job. So at Brookings, we consider this our top priority to bring folks together, discuss some of these problems, and figure out ways to move forward. Okay, we have a few minutes for questions, so I think there are some microphones around, so if you just raise your hand and we will get to you.
Somebody get us started. Yes.
Right there.
Only because you asked for volunteers. I wonder if you could talk on the export side, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between domestic and international markets, because the United States arguably helped the world economy by its deficits in its aggregate macroeconomic standpoint, but it also helped
places like Germany and Japan by establishing markets, and so their export-led growth was because they were selling into global markets that were dominated by the U.S. So what you're trying to do is kind of turn our situation completely around, because it's great to say let's promote exports, but U.S. companies have thought about exports as an add-on to large domestic markets. And so the what you're describing in terms of and more of an investment and savings-oriented economy means a reduction in domestic markets. So how do you thread this needle? You can't just tell people to kind of go export. There has to be some greater linkage between domestic markets and global markets.
Let me kick that one off at least. It takes two to tango, so you're right about that. If we're going to have a more balanced economy, then someone else has got to start reducing the surpluses that they have. And that's what we mean by global rebalancing, and it's particularly tough to do that in a time when the global economy is weak. I don't want to – there's a lot of blame that goes to China, particularly across the street where I was before. I don't want to pile on that, but I think China is an important part of the solution. It has to make sure its current account surplus, its trade surplus went down in the recession. It looks like it's starting to grow again. So it has to focus more on domestic demand and not look to exports as much as it has for its growth going forward. Europe overall, it's not quite in the same position. Germany is their export powerhouse, but Europe as a whole has run trade surpluses, but typically has been somewhat more balanced. Clearly, they have to do more on stimulating domestic demand. Another piece of this that I didn't mention that I have been accused of is advocating a weak dollar. And if I were truthful, I'd probably say, yes, I do advocate a weak dollar in the sense that the place we're at right now looks pretty good to me in terms of the U.S. being competitive. So I think that's one of the reasons we're growing exports. I don't really advocate a weak dollar. I advocate a dollar which allows U.S. Tradable goods industries, manufacturing, and services to compete globally. But your point is well taken. We can't do all of this alone. We have been a huge market for the rest of the world. If we are going to slow down that huge market in terms of our imports and increase our exports, we have to have another side to that coin, which is more domestic demand in the rest of the world.
Richard, let me just add this from a Metro perspective. I think this is partly a cultural issue for the United States because, and unlike many of our competitors, particularly in Europe, we are a growing nation. Okay, so we're at about 310 million now. We'll hit 400 million in the 2040s, and a lot of that is just off of our base and then new immigrants. So we still have a large domestic market. Culturally, that has meant that as people think about their metro economies, they're primarily thinking about region-serving industries and then perhaps exports within the United States, right? When we put forward this proposition going back about 2 years that we really needed a different growth model post-recession, I remember going to a session in Chicago with a group of business and civic leaders, and one of the civic leaders got up and said, why export? And by the way, who does Chicago trade with today? You know, and so what we've had as a narrative, partly because of our growing domestic market and partly because of the way housing and retail and consumption more broadly has dominated so much of the political and economic discourse in the country, we have folks who are really not cognizant of what they export. Now, obviously, the multinationals are very cognizant of what they export, but only 1% of American companies export, right? And only about 58% of those export to more than one country. So we've built up this culture, and obviously off a very large consumerism market, backed, frankly, by subsidies from the federal government on down. And we lost, even though we're the most demographically diverse country in the world, we're the most culturally insular. Right? Only 28% of Americans have a passport. So I think when the president put forward this notion that we should double exports in 5 years, it partly was a cultural notion of looking outside our borders and really thinking of the rise in urbanization and industrialization of other countries abroad as the potential for American goods and services. One last thing. If we did a survey today of the American consumer and asked, what does the United States import? I guarantee you everyone would be scrambling to tell you what we import, from the clothes we wear to the goods in our homes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They have a fairly good sense, I think. If we ask them, what do we export? I have to say even a lot of sophisticated folks would not be able to answer the question. And so, again, we have to change the narrative about the economy in the U.S. And Michael Spence and others have recently done some just phenomenal work about growth in the tradable sectors versus the non-tradable sectors over the last 30 years. We've got to change the narrative. We have to talk at that level about what kind of economy we want to build so that we can begin to provide the political, you know, environment to make some of the big changes we have to make.
And this is also an area where we need governance reform, because there are 12 different federal agencies that deal with exports.
Absolutely.
They contradict one another. There's no rationale for that system. So, you know, that's kind of a demonstration of the link between poor governance structures and poor policy outputs. There were, Steve.
So I totally agree with you with regard to this broad cultural change that you just alluded to, Bruce. But it's an enormous task.
Absolutely.
It starts with our people. It then flows to our government. And it completely reorients us in terms of truly being global. Yesterday, we discussed that, you know, the residual of the tech bubble was the technology infrastructure that existed around the world. And someone posited that the residual of the credit, you know, or the Great Recession was globalization. I think that's actually true for the world, with the exception of the United States. And our multinationals are the ones that responded well. But for the vast majority of our businesses, as you just alluded to, that has not happened. So the question I have is, how do we get the throw weight as an institution, Brookings, to affect this enormous change in this country?
I could start, and then obviously my colleagues can add. I really believe that a lot of the change is going to happen outside of Washington over the next several years, even beyond that. And because I really do believe, and Darrell said it, there is a pragmatic caucus out there of corporate, civic, political, environmental, labor leaders who put place over party, who really put collaboration over conflict. What they're about is improving their city, their metro, their state. Now, some of them act globally, but they also act locally. And this recession was a wake-up call, fundamentally a wake-up call. And it was a wake-up call in the Sun Belt, which, you know, talk about housing on steroids, right? That is the part of the country and parts of Florida and parts of Central Valley, California, that has just been built off of a housing economy. very little diversification. And part of it was in the industrial heartland, given the numbers, the brutal numbers that Martin put out. But I think there is that caucus out there. And, you know, we have this, you know, genius of American democracy was when Washington goes on a frolic and a detour, when the town shuts down, you know, and is in basically mired in excessive partisanship and polarization, we have a default proposition. We're not the UK. You know, we're not a centralized, we're a system where power is diffuse, both within the public sector and the private sector. And I think what we've got to watch over the next 3 to 5 years, and you've already seen it happen on the austerity front, I think we're going to see it on the economy building, talent preparing, placemaking front, where you're going to have mayors, governors, business leaders, university presidents, et cetera, across both sides of the aisle, vying to be the innovator in chief, and to be at the vanguard. Who's going to be first on the block and just fill in the missing, whether it's around clean energy, whether it's around manufacturing, you know, whether it's around placemaking. So I generally think that that's how we have to take the country back, is from the ground up. And that will require the media to begin to talk more about this innovative potential out in the hinterland, not just about the budget cutting, but the economy shaping. That's going to come next.
I think we have Senator Warner waiting to come on, so I don't know. You want to do it?
One more question?
One more question.
Antoine has a question. Sorry, there are lots of questions. We need time for 10 more questions.
You'll have to ask Senator Warner a question.
Just a very quick question. Do we have an export powerhouse in the United States? I mean, not all of Europe is an export powerhouse.
Right.
Germany is. And not all of China is an export powerhouse. The coast is. Do we have that? Seattle, perhaps? Or?
Seattle is an export powerhouse, certainly. I always thought it was kind of an irony. When I was in the Clinton administration, I was sent as a precursor to President Clinton going out there, and I was supposed to give a talk about globalization. Part of it got canceled because they didn't want to hear anything. But the thing that was sort of odd about that, all that Seattle stuff, is that the Boeing workers were demonstrating against globalization. And I thought, wait a minute.
Now that is
There's something really strange here.
That is the contradiction in terms. I think we are out of time on this session. So thank you very much for your question. Sorry we did not have more time. But I'd like to introduce Glenn Hutchins, the vice chair of the Brookings Board, and he will have the honor of introducing the senator.
Thank you. Wasn't that terrific? The Brookings, the intellectual content and the people behind it at Brookings is unparalleled. We just finished 3 days of meetings here, meeting one scholar after another like that, and have these great minds culminate these 3 days of meetings is really just very gratifying. It's my pleasure today to introduce someone who I call a friend, Mark Warner, senator from Virginia. But not only is he a distinguished senator, but before becoming a senator, he was a chief executive in both government and business. Before being elected senator in 2008, he was governor of Virginia, as we know, where I was born, and during one of the state's most difficult economic downturns. He worked very hard to make state government effective, which is a subject which we obviously talked about at great length in the growth and innovation agenda, and left turning a record budget deficit into a record surplus. He brought those skills to the United States Senate, has already had a huge impact, and particularly on the issues that the Growth and Innovation Project has been about. In fact, for our very first meeting, Mark came over and met with our group and gave us a lot of input and guidance that had an important impact on our agenda kind of as we went forward. You've just heard from Bruce, Martin, and Daryl about the three key areas the Growth and Innovation Initiative has been focused on. Restoring fiscal sanity, driving the innovation economy, and building more effective government. And during his tenure in the Senate, Mark has been a leader in each of these categories. The first of those efforts, restoring fiscal sanity, is something I think he's going to talk a little bit about today. And I'm sure you've all heard about the heroic effort that he's put on as a member of the Gang of Six, which is now going down to the Gang of Five. And John Thornton, I was going to suggest, if it gets to be a Gang of Four, maybe our China scholars can help him. Joke. Mark, we understand that that is truly a heroic effort. Doesn't always pay dividends to do what's right, and I want to make sure everyone here hears us say how much we appreciate kind of your leadership. And so now in that connection, I'm going to digress a minute from the agenda and just make a statement, which I would like to say, which is I want to make sure everybody in this room understands that it's my personal belief that defaulting on our nation's debt would be foolish and would invite a sharply adverse market reaction. Nobody in this town should be in under any other illusion than that. That's my personal belief, and I know others have disagreed and instead attached some probability, not certainty, but some probability only to the prospects for market calamity. Though I disagree with this, I point out to them that it is unwise in the extreme to take any probability of a catastrophic risk on behalf of your country. I guess it's just a very, very bad idea. I've also heard that the benign market reaction, the benign market climate with, for instance, 10-year treasuries at about 3%, is a signal from the market that things are sort of okay. In my personal view, this is because market participants expect a deal. They expect our government to do the right thing, and if only on the courthouse steps, but to get it done, and that the prospect for a default is not yet priced into the market. We should all understand that. So that's my digression for the day. In addition to his work on fiscal sanity, Mark has done a lot of work on driving innovation. He, as I said earlier, he was a chief executive also in the private sector as a director not just of Columbia Capital Corporation, which is a very important venture capital firm, but also as a founder of Nextel, which became one of the most important drivers of the new communications economy, the benefits of which associated with mobility we're just beginning to experience as an important part of not only our personal lives but our nation's prosperity. He has done a lot of work in the Senate on the innovation agenda, along with a bipartisan group of senators, including Senators Klobuchar, Brown, Alexander, Coons, and perhaps others. They've sponsored the Innovation America Act, which we here at Brookings think is very important. And finally, he's the chairman of the Bipartisan Task Force on Government Performance, the subject which Darrell West has talked about, seeks ways to make government both more efficient and transparent. So there's not a better senator to speak to us today and not a person more closely allied with what's at the heart of what the Growth Through Innovation agenda is all about. So, Mark, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here today.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Glenn. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for your leadership in the financial markets. Thank you for your leadership here at Brookings. And I have been looking forward to this session. Today is going to be a full day. I go from here to the Peterson Institute, where we've got Alice. You were probably there last night, where we've got the Unbowed and Determined Gang is going to appear en masse. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about that subject. But I do want to start with a thanks to all of the good work that Brookings has done over the years, has done on this growth and innovation agenda, and how much we're going to need Brookings and the people in this room in this coming and ongoing struggle. And I'm going to take most of my comments on the subject that I know you have spent a lot of time on already, on debt and deficit, but I want to put some front end on this because I do think, we cannot cut our way or tax our way alone out of this problem. You got to have growth. And you have identified a series of subjects, both kind of macro and micro, and I want to give a little more, at least kind of my 2 cents worth, on some of those ideas on how we get that growth, and then how we, if all of the speakers so far, or Glenn's comments today, haven't appropriately frightened you about the debt and deficit crisis this country faces, I want to try to take my crack Martin at it to deal with the immediacy of it. So on the front end, I want to touch on what I would call kind of low-hanging fruit that doesn't actually cost a lot of money, that frankly just takes a little bit of political will and a little more oomph from, thinkers like you all in the room. I am glad that you put the government effectiveness title in this growth and innovation piece. It is often overlooked. It is not sexy, but I want to give a couple specific comments on that. I'm going to do a short riff on, the kind of macro items that you've talked about because you've heard a lot about it, and frankly, if we don't get our debt and deficit, the ability to make the larger term macro investments, then I want to give you a bit of my take on debt and deficit and leave us plenty of time for questions. So with that, completely well thought out speech I've got here, I want to do that. Let's start with some of the low hanging fruit, that I'm just going to, kind of more or less tick off, and in the question period, if we want to get into greater depth on them. These are things that some have been emphasized in your report, some have not been, but they are areas where I think we could take, not next year, not decade long, but this year action in terms of moving that innovation and growth agenda along. First, we have made some strides recently in terms of intellectual property protection and PTO reform, but we have been timid. It should not take 3 years in the United States to get from idea through a patent process and an IP process. And since this is one of the self-funding pieces of our government, the notion that it has become a revolving door at the PTO and that we don't end up increasing the capability and speeding up that process is kind of, to my mind, a no-brainer. A cousin to that, and one that is that my friends in bio and medical tech are familiar with, but it really continues to constantly make me scratch my head, is why we're not looking at also speeding up the process at the FDA. It shouldn't take 13 years and $1 billion to get an idea from idea into the marketplace. And I believe we can do appropriate things to protect both medical efficacy and patient protection in a way both from the pharma notions and medical devices in a much speedier process at the FDA. And the fact that the EU, with even its price controls, has cut that process time in half and is starting to move some of our intellectual capital creation in this, the great promised area of life sciences, which has been kind of promised for 20 years yet, and we still haven't seen the full delivery, it would be an enormous loss. And again, FDA reform, I think, needs to be higher on the agenda. Somewhat self-serving sounding, and my good friends like Steve Ricchetti and Nigel Morse, Nigel, great addition to your board, have heard me do a million times my fact that since I was the co-founder of Nextel, I'm the guy that says leave your cell phones on even when I'm speaking. There are a few people that haven't heard that joke, obviously, in this room, but it is the key into the next piece. We have enormous unused assets with spectrum, and where we are in terms of getting that spectrum into the marketplace, grappling with our broadcasters in an appropriate way with incentive auctions, trying to catch up to the South Koreas and the Europes, who are much further ahead of us on spectrum deployment and the wonderful opportunities that it will allow in terms of mobility, in terms of technology. It's just ridiculous. And again, the FCC's made some progress, but it needs a much greater oomph. One of the areas that you've talked about as well is the need to have infrastructure. What was forever, to the middle of the 20th century, a competitive advantage in our country is increasingly a competitive disadvantage. And while we can get to kind of long-term funding flows around infrastructure, there are short-term, relatively cheap. I've got a bill that actually John Kerry has been the lead on, but with Kay Bailey Hutchinson on a slimmed-down version of the $30 billion plus Obama infrastructure investment bank that would be a $10 billion infrastructure investment bank that would be loans only. In today's climate, we can do it. And we ought to be doing it. Something that's keyed up this year that we need to move forward on is the FTAs. They are there. They are ready. Let's move forward on them. Now we ought to make sure that the Trade Assistance Act in communities, we sometimes in metropolitan areas see all the benefits of globalization. I can take you, let me assure you, to parts of my state in Southside Virginia that were long textiles, tobacco, and furniture that aren't doing as well. And this transition fund and this ability to move forward on trade but also make sure that we do the TAA is important. And it brings me to my kind of last on the low-hanging fruit is we really need to have policies in this country that promote insourcing. The price labor arbitrage and competitive advantages that used to move back office operations and others to India and elsewhere are dramatically lowering. And the opportunities in rural Virginia, and I can give you the numbers on a number of firms that we've taken to Southwest Virginia, that delta has dramatically decreased. And again, if we're going to maintain the support for kind of moving into the global economy, we cannot afford to leave rural communities behind. And with small little add-ons, Virginia could beat the pants off of New York or California or even North Carolina on competitive. When we were competing against Koreas and Canadas and others where there was a federal additional subsidy in terms of insourcing of jobs, a little more difficult. I've got some ideas specifically there. That one batch on low-hanging fruit. Second, government effectiveness. Let me tell you in 30 seconds or more in a minute about what may be the, I hope, the littlest, most important bill you've never heard of that I was proud to author last year called the GIPRA, basically Government Performance Modernization Act. What it does is it finally for the first time requires all of our government agencies, rather than to have what we do in Congress load up, you know, 57 different priorities, to actually try to limit those priorities to 3 to 5. Anybody in business knows if you got 57 priorities, you got no priorities. But this focuses on a quarterly basis, on a single source website for every government agency, both to report, you know, its priorities and limit them to 3 to 5. Secondarily, what it does, and this is really where the rubber will hit the road, and we got actually pushback from the administration, it will require government agencies to report not only their top performing programs, but their least performing programs. You know, everybody wants to be there to announce their new idea, but our ability to kind of clear out the underbrush and eliminate underperforming programs is something that is, we did some at the state level, it's hard, it's exponentially harder at the federal level. This will give us a tool, number one. Number two, and this is something I've actually worked with Tom Coburn on, and I think there's a lot of unplowed ground here, and that is the GAO study that talks about government duplication. You know, we've all heard the stories, and the experts here will have the numbers. You know, I think it's about 42 different workforce training programs across, you know, 4 or 5 different cabinet secretaries. You can say the same thing on food safety. There is our savings to be had and confidence to be built if we can consolidate on government duplication. Third thing, and this is something that is not announced yet, but there's been papers done, and I'm hopeful and would love to have this group become supportive of it, that the administration may move forward. And that is, if we're going to move forward on, as we need to, and the president has called in terms of doubling exports, we've got to rationalize all of our trade-supporting entities within Commerce Department, how they're spread all across the government. Let's face it. Most American businesses for the last 50 years had the luxury of the largest market in the world. They didn't need to export. But with 95% of all the customers in the 21st century being abroad, we have to make sure that there is a rational process for small and middle-sized enterprises to be able to penetrate this impenetrable mass of export support facilities. And then one, just I've got a lot of nodding heads that's a little more radical that I've been working on, is to, you know, take a major step forward on regulatory reform. And we have actually, Nigel, this pains me to say this, but we've borrowed this from the Brits, and the Brits are actually ahead of us on this. And I grew up in the age when we used to point out Britain is the place of the epitome of, you know, regulatory morass. I have a proposal that I think we'll be putting forward fairly shortly called regulatory PAYGO, which realigns the incentives inside of agencies so that you don't have an agency any longer that simply tries to add more regulations with the benefit of getting additional staff and resources, but would put in place something that says as you add a new regulation, you actually have to take one away of kind of equal size and shape. Now, you can't do this forever, but as a way to kind of clear out some of the underbrush, because we've never got incentives in place to try to make sure that you think twice in terms of a regulatory budget moving forward, how you get this right, is something that we've been working about a year on. And before you say, gosh, Warner, that sounds great, but it couldn't happen, the Brits have actually done it. They call it one in and one out. And over the last 11 months, 10 months that they've done it, they've seen about a 70% decline. They still feel like they're getting effectiveness, but what they end up finding is that if an agency can do it for 70% effectiveness and 25% of the costs, you get that internal workings of the agency aligned in a better way than kind of some of the cost-benefit approaches we have right now. Because I'm going through my time, I will spare you the energy, R&D, immigration, and host of other subjects. But I do want to get to the issue now of the kind of the main course, which is echoing what Glenn has said, and I'm sure you've heard from others, and I won't give you all of the facts again about the impending debt and debt crisis, but, you know, it's wild if we don't act on this. $14.5 trillion in debt, and Alice, correct me if I'm wrong, minimum of $4 billion a day, every day that we fail to act, that we add to that debt. We are looking at the most predictable financial crisis of our lives. I use the analogy, you know, that we are kind of, anybody here see the movie Thelma and Louise? Remember that? Where at the end they jump in the car and go racing towards the cliff? Well, that's what we're doing right now. We are racing toward the cliff, and unlike the financial crisis in 2008, we've used all our bullets. We've used monetary policy about as much as you can. We've used fiscal stimulus. We've used financial institution bailout. And the idea, as Glenn has said, that there are some, with a movie analogy again, in the House who are acting like this sheriff in Blazing Saddles with the gun against their head and saying, watch out, if you come any closer, I'm going to shoot. By threatening default, it's just crazy. And the idea that this is somehow can be analogized to previous gamesmanship is just flat wrong. With the potential growing debt crisis in Europe, and we'll soon see the ramifications of the Spanish elections on Sunday, you know, how much more kind of potential problems there may be there. With the level of kind of global instability, instability in the commodity prices, we are now going to pick this moment in time with debt approaching that kind of magic, what is it, 80, 90% of GDP numbers? We're going to now threaten that? You know, what are these people thinking? Oh, you know, you think about, you know, in a certain macro sense, if we step back for a moment, you know, I remember 2 years ago at this point, and Glenn, I don't know what your predictions were, but when, you know, the economy was losing 700,000 jobs a month, and, you know, the Dow was at 6,500, and we just lost 6.5% of our GDP, I think most of us would have said, well, if you can give me spring of 2011 with the Dow at 12.4 or 12.3 and, you know, three, four quarters straight of positive GDP growth and a couple months straight of about 200,000 job growth, that would be, you know, relatively good considering how far down we were, a relatively good recovery. Now, not enough on the job front. But the idea that we would roll the dice on a potential interest rate spike coming at the end of QE2 is just irresponsible beyond the pale. So what does that mean? It means that we've got to be serious about this. And we've got, and again, I hate to use the Brits, but the fact that, you know, the coalition government in the UK has actually bit this bullet and started to go down the path as imperfect as it is, it's downright un-American that we're going to let the Brits beat us on both, you know, regulatory reform and fiscal rationality. I know you saw Congressman Ryan. I have a lot of respect for Congressman Ryan, a lot of respect for his willingness to put out a plan. But if anything, what Congressman Ryan's plan shows, meaning leave the whole Medicare debate off to the side, it shows how virtually impossible this job is to get done when you exclude revenues and when you exclude defense. The debate about Congressman Ryan's plan has been about what it does to Medicare and Medicaid. You know, we can have a philosophical debate there. But Brookings is also, in the subject of your project, is growth and innovation. What the part that should be more concerning about Congressman Ryan's plan for us who want to have a growth and innovation agenda is how you take the 12% of domestic discretionary spending, which includes energy, which includes infrastructure, which includes R&D, which includes education, which includes preschool, which includes all the things we fight about, and take it from 12%, you know, depending on how you analyze this budget, to either 6% or 4%. Tell me what industrial country in the 21st century is going to compete with those kind of numbers that would be all in infrastructure, energy, R&D, education in a way that's competitive. Now, we know the problem, and this is, again, where both sides have to give. Spends at 25% of GDP, all-time high. Revenues, Alice, 15.3, 15.4 right now, 60-year low. It doesn't take a Brookings scholar to realize that Delta is not sustainable. And the five times we've had it, 19.5% to 20.5%, basically, roughly, revenues and spending. So, starting last year, Saxby Chambliss, who I have enormous respect for Senator Chambliss, you know, we started talking about this on the floor, and we decided, and candidly, for about 6 months, we managed to do it without, and for folks like George Tunis knowing about it, that we would start educating our colleagues about, you know, the basic components of how we spend and how we raise money. This canon will be used against me, right, what I say?
Yes.
Some of you may be surprised at how many colleagues don't understand the basic building blocks of how we raise money or spend money at the federal level. We took then the framework of the Simpson-Bowles report, not perfect. Some would say, you know, Rivlin Domenici would be better, but, you know, we took Simpson-Bowles, took the other four senators and who voted for it and said, let's use this as a frame, and had been at it for months on end. The press reports of our demise are overrated. The press reports of that we couldn't reach agreement on numbers and everything else, I don't think reflect what really happened. And, you know, we are still continuing to discuss, and what we basically have had, and I give a lot more credit to the more senior members who are part of this group. I'm a new guy. I'm still come from the world of business and state government when you actually had to balance your budget. So, you know, it's not a foreign thought to me. But we have gone through this process in a way that I think has been, you know, what the Senate is supposed to have been about, where, you know, we have looked at the notion that through tax reform, meaningful tax reform on both the business side and on the individual side, you can make our tax code simpler, lower rates, raise more revenues, and still maintain or improve progressivity. We have recognized that 15-16% of our budget spend on defense can't be excluded. And, you know, as somebody who believes we ought to follow the commanders, well, Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, has said the single biggest threat to our country is not the threat of terrorism, but is this debt and deficit crisis. And the fact that America spends more than the next 15 nations in the world, largest nations in the world, on defense combined, means that we can still maintain the world's greatest defense, which we should not sacrifice, but we can do it at a more cheap basis. And it does mean that outside that window of domestic discretionary, we do have to take on our entitlement programs. I get a lot of grief on the Democratic side. You know, Social Security doesn't contribute to the deficit. You're right. Anything we should do to make sure Social Security is solvent for 75 years should not, a dollar of it should not go to the deficit. But those who say that we can ignore this problem, I mean, it's not Democrat or Republican's fault. Correct me if I'm wrong, the example I always use was that Bismarck was the person who originally set 65 as the retirement age when he was premier in Germany, because average life expectancy was in the mid-50s. So if you outlive the actuarial tables, we'll give you a check. It's not a bad deal for the government. You know, Roosevelt in 34, life expectancy was 62. It's now 80. 17 workers for every one retiree in 1950, now 3. It's math. So the hope that I have, and the perhaps naive assumption, is that, you know, again, not to kind of have my Brit focus today, but, you know, to paraphrase Churchill, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. Well, in our political process, we've tried everything else at this point. We've tried political brinksmanship. And I personally was embarrassed to be a member of the Congress when we almost shut down the government 6 or 8 weeks ago over basically nothing. But the notion that we're going to do brinksmanship again, and the failure, and I think echoing Glenn's comment, of some of the colleagues to not understand that you can't go to the 11th and a half hour right now before you might spook the bond market, makes the recognition, and I believe that the only place that this effort can start, and I hope, you know, Vice President Biden will be successful, but I think at the end of the day, the only way that we can get a real comprehensive plan in place, and not one that simply limps us through the debt limit, is to start in the Senate in a bipartisan fashion. And if we don't have a plan that makes at least every one of you partially mad, we haven't done our job. and then ask everybody to kind of check their Democrat and Republican hats for a moment and step up, as this country's always willing to do. And, you know, this, for my generation, is our moment of time. The growth and innovation agenda that the scholars have put forward and this institute has put together is wonderful. But if, with a maxed-out credit card and an inability to meet basic services and pay our bills, if we can't do that, then this innovation and growth agenda becomes kind of one more policy paper that'll never get acted on. So I appreciate the chance to be here. I appreciate the chance to speak to you. We're going to need you more than ever as we get in. And I'm chomping at the bit to get into the fray. But we're going to need you not just as thinkers. We're going to need you as pushers, prodders, advocates to make sure the country steps up and puts this long-term debt and deficit reduction plan in place to make sure that we can focus on the growth and innovation we need. Thank you very much.
Mark, have a seat. Not only is it good to have a competitor out of the business, but it's great to have you what you're doing. Thank you. And I want to echo in particular one thing which Mark said, which is let a thousand flowers bloom. Lee and I will not be pleased unless you all are multitasking all through this kind of presentation today, because you're using the economy that he and I have helped to try to help to foster. I'm going to ask Mark a couple of quick questions and then go to the group here. We have a terrific mix here of Brookings scholars, Brookings trustees, some members of the press, and others here. So we have a great group of folks here to ask questions. So get ready, because you'll be called on very shortly. There's a lot of interest in kind of the dynamics, the inside ball game of the Gang of Six. I'm not being a journalist, I'm not going to ask you that question, but you...
good, because I'm not going to tell you.
Good. That's why I didn't ask you. No, but I want to ask you a related question, if I might, which is that you talked about what people had to learn, your colleagues had to learn about the budget process. And I'm curious, as you've gotten into this and as you've dealt with the Gang of Six, what you've learned. What's most surprised you and what you didn't know before that you think is most important that you now understand?
I think, frankly, fully understanding, and whether it was Alice's work or Simpson Bowles' work, the coming to a full understanding of how much we spend on tax expenditures and how that category has kind of been overlooked in all past discussions was one that was something I learned a lot about, and how that you can still actually, through modifications of those tax expenditures, you really can go ahead and dramatically lower rates and improve progressivity and raise more revenue. I think that has been helpful to me. I think recognizing, you kind of knew it, but I could have cited you chapter and verse at the state budget level, but I didn't fully appreciate at the federal level, as a percentage of spend, how little we spend on infrastructure, R&D, energy, the small education component, preschool, all these kind of, some of the safety net programs. I mean, it's a smaller, again, correct me if I'm wrong, smaller percentage on some of those categories than we spend as a percentage of our GDP in Eisenhower. So it's those were a couple of the things that I didn't fully appreciate, how much our federal government has kind of become simply a transfer program to some people who need, some people just because of the aging of our society.
So let's dig into one piece of this, which I think is interesting to hear you talk about. We are, regardless of what your deficit reduction target is, whether it's an amount of money, $4, $6, $8 trillion over 10 years, or whether it's a target on the debt, total amount of debt, do you want it to be the same size as GDP, not growing, whatever it might be, it's a lot of revenue that's going to have to be raised, a lot of spending is going to have to be cut in a time period which, as you've emphasized, and which the scholars who wrote our Growth Through Innovation strategy paper have focused on, we need investments in a whole variety of parts of our economy to make it competitive. How do you think about, have you developed a philosophy or a framework or any guide to thinking about how you make that trade-off?
I think you've a couple of things. As we think about investments, we think about job creation, I believe that while there are things we can still do marginally around the edges, government-wise, that we've kind of used our biggest tools in terms of monetary policy and fiscal stimulus. And that, you know, the best thing we've got that we haven't unleashed at this point, and that we didn't have when the crisis hit in 2008, was we've got the potential of the, what is it, $2.2, $2.3 trillion in cash sitting on America corporate balance sheets. You know, the best thing we can do is give the confidence that we are going to be serious about this debt and deficit reduction plan that I think would loosen up a lot of that private sector capital to come back into the marketplace. And that would be the best job creation we could do. Number two, I do think, you know, we have, as kind of reserve currency and the size of our economy, we've got some time. I think the most important thing is to show the seriousness of a plan that it can be phased in over a decade. You know, and we are north now of where Simpson-Bowles have in terms of our peg total of what we get, but you're not going to solve the whole $14.5 trillion debt in a 10-year time frame. We just got to move that curve, as you know, both on a percent of GDP and in terms of the overall total debt to GDP level, back down in the right direction. And so that we can not, and again, this is one of my, you know, I give Congressman Ryan enormous credit, but I think he underestimates that ability to make the kind of, you know, continued necessary investments around a stable energy policy, around R&D, around infrastructure, which you got to pay for. And, you know, how we rethink some of our education policy. So I do think we've got a little time that, again, it's why I am not as I hope and pray that Steve Ricchetti, all you conventional wisdom people sitting in this room, you know, that we don't just end up with something that kind of buys us through the debt limit and kicks this can down to 2013. I think the one thing that may have changed is conventional Washington wisdom is still that the big plan, the big reform probably wouldn't happen until 2013. You know, I think everybody thought 6 or 8 months ago we had that freedom. You know, I don't know if we've got that flexibility anymore. And even if the probability is only kind of 10 or 20% of fiscal crisis happening if we don't put a long-term plan in place, why would we put that, why would we take that gamble when you come back to the notion of, you know, that I become a, I never thought I'd say this, but I become a fan of that debt clock, you know, that you see, you know, I just get haunted by this notion of, you know, $4 billion plus a day, and that's been political fact-checked. You know, that this is not a self-correcting problem.
If anybody hasn't seen it, the one on the web is really terrific. I know our two reporters here are racing. No, not yet, not yet. Hang on, guys. One last question for you. We all know Medicare. We all understand that entitlements have to be reformed on the one hand, and that that's going to be one of the most important parts of the meeting of the minds in order to get this problem behind us. Paul Ryan, who was here yesterday, took a courageous step and came out and came forward with a proposal, which the Democrats seem to be relishing as a potentially major political mistake, and certainly in light of yesterday's election. And so the question is, how you said something, which I've heard a lot of people say, we can have a debate about the philosophies of Medicare, about the philosophies of the other entitlements, and let's do that. So I'm not going to ask you to take a position. I'm not trying to put you in a bad spot. I'm just curious how you think about the philosophy of that debate.
Well, I mean, I think Paul Ryan, you know, put out again a different vision of Medicare. Yeah, but the problem of whether you have kind of defined contribution and defined benefit plan still doesn't get at the core of the issue of lowering healthcare costs. Increasing medical technology, aging population, without some ability to limit your financial exposure, you've got fiscal demise under any circumstance, and no matter what plan you have. So, you know, we were talking, again, I've been trying to keep the We've been pretty good about keeping our details to ourselves. But, you know, Simpson Bowles took some tentative steps in this direction. And, you know, we think that we've got to put all that on the table. And one of the things that and one of the reasons why I think some of the plans have not gained much traction yet. There is nothing intellectually better about a bipartisan plan over a partisan plan. But I think the vast majority of Americans, these numbers are so large. And frankly, what they do is they hire us to try to sort this through a little bit. And bipartisanship has become a bit of a code that's, because I don't think the American public trusts either political party enough to give them a blank check. And, you know, bipartisan becomes kind of code that, maybe it's in the country's interest. I think America will step up if they feel like everybody's got some skin in the game. And the portrayals, at least, not all accurate, whether the president's plan or Mr. Ryan's plan, is that they were not asking everybody to do their part. They were asking certain segments of society to do a disproportionate amount.
So now, would you mind, I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative here, would you mind taking a question or two from our members from the press here before we move on to the... Okay. Ruth, you're first.
And No.
John,
no.
You have to
okay. Senator, a few questions about what you've learned about the political...
A few.
Well, about the political process through all of this. What have you concluded about its capacity to address problems this large? Are you more or less confident than you were when you started? And if you are confident, because I know you're an optimistic guy, then how do you get out of that blazing saddle scenario?
Well,
as a Mel Brooks fan, I'd like to say I really appreciate.
I do hope that, you know, kind of the blazing saddles mentality of some folks, that folks can educate them. You know, that you know, default on the debt is, you know, even if I'm wrong, politician, why would you take that chance when the consequences would be so dire, number one? Number two, and you've heard this from me before, so this is more for the rest of the audience, you know, I was governor with a state that was 2-1 Republican legislature. We had a structural deficit. Everybody said that I was signing a political death warrant by trying to take on that issue. Now, I had some wonderful, wonderful partners in the legislature, Republican partner, but we got it done, and it was good policy, good politics. And I think people are hungering for that right now. I think one of the greatest tragedies, maybe too strong, you know, one of the greatest mistakes made by the potential government shutdown was it not only made us all look bad, but it also kind of re-raised that issue is, are our institutions up to taking on big challenges?
Exactly.
And if we rob the American people of that faith, then we have done such, you know, we have done such a disservice. I mean, because as important as a debt and deficit issue, if we lose faith in our institutions at the same time of governance, then we are really up the creek. So, you know, I've had a lot of things in this process that have discouraged me, but I've also had the kind of hour-on-end discussion with members that, you know, you could write a book on, of people trying to go beyond their comfort zone and say, I get it, we gotta make this happen. And that gives me faith. I mean, you know, and time will tell. I mean, what's the alternative? You throw in the towel.
Senator John Hilzenrath from the Wall Street Journal. You talked about life expectancy and the retirement age at the time of Bismarck. I wonder if we could look forward to 2040, 2050, and if you could tell us what you think the retirement age for Social Security and also for Medicare should be in those years.
No.
Next question?
Yeah, no, but listen, I can't predict, but I also think that you know, there are ways to think through this, and let's just put it like this to kind of tantalize. We've got some ideas on this, an approach that might be different than some of the other proposals out there. You know, and just
so
because,
if you won't tell us, will you promise to come back to Brookings when you're ready to talk about it?
But I'm just saying that, you know, I just believe that this issue is probably going to have to be revisited on a more regular basis than every 40 or 50 years when there's a crisis.
Well, just let me try a gentler way to ask the question. How much of the debt and deficit problem can be addressed by turning that dial of adjusting retirement?
I think there are.
Now take the microphone away from us. Last question.
It's one of the factors. You know, listen, if you're putting everything on the table, you put everything on the table. But the thing is, anybody that thinks that there is kind of the single silver bullet approach, I think it's just flat wrong.
That's right.
And frankly, naive.
Questions? We have, I think, 10 more minutes.
I'm going to go to the opposite end of the spectrum. Ruth asked you a very nuanced question, and I'm going to ask you one that's much more pointed, but along the same lines, and that is we have leadership, political leadership, drawing some very incredibly straight lines in the sand. There will be no tax changes, let alone tax increases, and so on. How much of that is posturing? How much of that feeds into the sentiment that you were referring to in terms of creating a sense of the Congress as being unreasonable and willing to take chances on brinksmanship as opposed to statesmanship on this?
There's been a lot of things in Washington that haven't been the Virginia way. You know, I hope, I don't know how we get out of that, you know, people who want to push more, you know, what exception, you know, I don't know how we get out of that, but I don't think we can play to the, you know, to the groups in this town on both sides who basically don't want to see anything happen. Because the status quo is their livelihood. It's why, you know, if and when, and I emphasize when, you know, we or someone else puts out something that is broad and bipartisan and an approach that, you know, everybody won't go to the first line of saying, well, let me see what part on subsection 7C that spikes my particular. You know, if there is ever a time when you got to all be in it together, it is right now. And I think that I have yet to be in any audience in Virginia or anywhere else where, you know, the logic of this argument, and when you put the pie, you know, and the good thing because of this audience, you didn't have to endure my PowerPoint. But when you go through the facts, I mean, a lot of politics is great, but some of these things are so overwhelming at this point. The idea that you can fix this problem on simply on one side of the ledger or the other just doesn't pass the smell test.
One last question. Anybody else?
One or two. I mean, I know what.
Oh, you're Stroh, were you waving a hand right now?
Ah,
Virginian, yes. Greek, Hellenic Virginian.
We try not to follow the California model or the Greek model.
Just from Charlottesville.
Or the New York State model,
exactly.
For that Charlottesville, from Charlottesville, where we take advantage of neoclassical architecture.
Amen. Right. Amen.
The gang is five or six. I just
or read. 64 that signed the letter about... 6 weeks ago, that didn't get any coverage in any publication, I don't think. But you know, maybe got a little note. But
four years ago, there was a gang of 14. The number of moderates in the Senate has dwindled, and according to a number of analyses, the most conservative Democrat is to the left of the most liberal Republican. And in the House, it's almost non-existent, the overlap between the Democratic and the Republican Party. On a retail basis, I can imagine that that's on the one hand easier. There are fewer people you have to talk to until you start expanding outside the circle. But on a wholesale basis, how much of a sense that you get is there a public movement of independent voters, moderate voters, advocating on behalf of this? And how much of a difference does that make in a political system that doesn't translate into that number of votes on the Hill?
I think, you know, I can't speak to the House. You would be, virtually every one of you here would be surprised at the members, Democratic and Republican members, who've come up to me, and I know come up to all of my colleagues during this process who have been involved in it, and say, hang in there. Keep going. You're our only hope. Who fall outside of what you would, you know, define the kind of political moderates. You know, and part of that may just be the realization that kind of if you dig yourself into these bright line holes or put yourself in these foxholes, when you really have this impending crisis with very few tools left, yeah, that we could be in a heap of trouble. And I think that, you know, that the, and this is political truism 101, I know, but, you know, kind of loudest voices dominate the market. I think, you know, the emergence, I have, as somebody who asked people in Virginia to hire me as a bipartisan radical centrist, I mean, one, it's still not an oxymoron. It is hard, but it's not impossible. And I absolutely believe with all my heart that, that people are yearning for that.
We have time
for last bite.
One last question.
George?
Thank you, Senator. Wonderful to see you.
Great to see you.
I think it's even worse. You have $1.5 trillion deficit. If you use gap accounting, it's arguably $5 trillion. You know, that's probably 3 or 4 times more than the revenue we're bringing in. We're playing the short end of this curve in terms of how we finance our debt. In Great Britain, you know, their average treasury is 13 years. Here it's 5. We're spending $285 billion a year paying our interest on the debt at a blended rate of 2.25%. Historically, it's 5. Historically, it's 5%. It seems to me when the 2-year treasury stops being at 52 bips and gets back to normal levels, which it will, that's $700 billion a year just to pay our debt. At some point in time, you know, those numbers speak of a once great nation on a very serious decline.
Amen. You know, and you have, and that portion of the pie where all the debate has for the most part focused right now and in the government shutdown, that domestic discretionary of how much further you can squeeze, you know, well, what happens is the interest totally eats that completely up. And everything that Brookings is talking about here today disappears. And your ability then to be that, you know, I guess this was kind of a, you know, a Greek handoff here. You know, the ability for us to kind of make those continued investments is going to, that's why I come back to you, my premise. There can be no sacred cows. You gotta have that safety net because there is also part of this that says, you know, many in this room have benefited from globalization, but there are a lot of people in this country that are really hurting. They've got to feel that they've still got that hope and they've still got those aspirations. But it starts with putting a plan that reforms our tax code, that takes on our entitlement spending, that takes on our other kind of spend, and has an active and energetic growth and innovation agenda. And I, you know, just make this appeal to you. You know, it is, you know, standard line of mine, but you got to check your Democrat and Republican hats. You know, we are going to need you to do more than sit here. You know, as this battle gets even more engaged. And, you know, those of you who never cross the line, I don't care which political party you are, you know, you got... If you're Democrats in this room and you got some brave Republicans stepping on this, you need to thank them and support them and vice versa. Because if you sit, chances are, particularly I'm speaking to the trustees, if you sit on the trustees board, you've all done pretty well, darn well in this country. And it's time for all of us who've done well to step up because the alternative, as George has so articulately put out in terms of kind of how the imminency of this problem and the threat to our country is so great.
So, Strobe, I think that brings our meetings to a conclusion, right? So I'd like to thank you and Bill and the staff at Brookings for putting on just a couple of great days, both the International Advisory Committee meetings and the board meetings. And it would appear that we did save the best for last. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Glenn.
Senator, thanks for coming.